From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actor Morgan Freeman. He just directed his first film, Bopa. It's set in South Africa and stars Danny Glover and Alfre Woodard. Our interview with Andrew Gowers about his biography of Yasser Arafat has been postponed till Wednesday. Also today, dispatches from the front. We talk with journalist Malcolm Brown about his 20 years as a foreign correspondent, 10 of which he spent in Vietnam, where he accompanied soldiers in combat and was shot down by enemy fire. Malcolm Brown has written a new memoir. And commentator Annie Lamott tells us about her stint defending single motherhood on national TV. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate has accepted the recommendations of the Base Closure Commission, assuring that 130 military facilities nationwide will close and another 45 will be scaled back. The cost-saving measure will mean the loss of tens of thousands of jobs. The Senate was actually voting on a measure to disapprove the recommendations of the Base Closure Commission. By law, those recommendations have to take effect unless both the House and Senate vote to reject the entire package. Most of the job losses from the latest round of base closures will be concentrated in California, Florida, and South Carolina. President Clinton aimed his health care pitch at doctors today. NPR's Mara Liasson reports from the White House.
Of all the interest groups in the health care debate, doctors have unique clout. They can lobby their patients one by one. So today at the White House, the President and First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton assembled a captive audience of physicians. President Clinton told 100 doctors that health care reform must preserve close patient-doctor relationships and the high quality of doctors, nurses, academic research, and technology. The Clintons have named former Surgeon General Everett Koop to organize a series of forums that are designed to give doctors information about the White House plan. Today, Koop urged the doctors to support the health care reform, saying that disagreement with one or two details in the president's plan should not be an excuse to oppose the whole program. Koop served as Surgeon General under Presidents Reagan and Bush, but today he praised Clinton, saying he had already accomplished more in health care reform than all of his living predecessors put together. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Israeli warplanes attacked positions held by the pro-Iranian Hezbollah in South Lebanon after a day of rocket and artillery duels between Hezbollah guerrillas and Israeli troops. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
The Islamic fundamentalist Hezbollah opposes the agreement between the PLO and Israel for Palestinian self-rule in the occupied territories and has vowed to do whatever it can to disrupt the deal. Two Israeli jets today fired four rockets on Hezbollah positions in South Lebanon, east of the port city of Sidon. There was no immediate report of casualties or damage, but witnesses said a cloud of black smoke billowed over the area. The Israeli attack came after Hezbollah guerrillas fired Katyusha rockets and exchanged artillery fire with Israeli troops inside the area Israel calls its security zone in South Lebanon. In July, Israel launched a one-week intensive bombardment of South Lebanon and has threatened to respond harshly if Hezbollah fires Katyusha rockets at northern Israel. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 37 points to close at 3,575.8. Declines led advances by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR News in Washington. Intense fighting continued today around the Black Sea town of Sukhumi as Abkhazian separatists attacked government troops in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. Large parts of the city were said to be burning from steady artillery bombardments. The fight continued despite the reported signing of a ceasefire agreement yesterday. Abkhazian rebels launched their offensive last week after a seven-week ceasefire mediated by Russia. Some Georgians believe that Russian nationalists are supporting the rebellion in an effort to destabilize the independent Georgian government. A federal judge has overturned the convictions of seven Chicago street gang members, ruling that they were denied a fair trial because of misconduct by prosecutors. From Chicago, NPR's Edward Lifson reports.
New trials were ordered today in the cases against businessman Noah Robinson, who is a half-brother of the Reverend Jesse Jackson, and six reputed leaders of the El Rucan street gang. U.S. District Court Judge Marvin Aspin was the third federal judge to order new trials for the gang members or their associates on the grounds that prosecutors knew of special favors given to government witnesses during the trials. For example, one of the witnesses had tested positive for drugs, but this was never revealed to defense attorneys or the court. Today's decision to overturn the convictions was the latest setback for federal prosecutors, who had put together an unprecedented 6-year probe of the gang that led to 53 convictions or guilty pleas. I'm Edward Lipson in Chicago.
The Georgia Parole Board granted probation today to a black teenager who'd been sentenced to 3 years in prison for stealing ice cream. The parole board decided to review the case of DeHundra Caldwell after the harsh sentence received wide publicity. The 17-year-old high school junior, his brother, and a friend took ice cream bars from a school cafeteria freezer. Critics say the case pointed up the harsher treatment that's given to black people in rural Georgia. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Morgan Freeman is a great actor. Critics and audiences agree. He starred in Glory, Driving Miss Daisy, Unforgiven, and Lean on Me. But he didn't have a major screen role until 1980, when he was 50 years old. The film was Street Smart. Pauline Kael began her review of the movie by asking the question, is Morgan Freeman the greatest American actor? A lot of other people seem to be asking the same question. He received an Academy Award nomination and the New York Critics Circle Award for the film. Now Freeman is making his directorial debut. The movie is called BOPA. It's set in South Africa and stars Danny Glover as a black member of the South African police, who is often called on to arrest his own neighbors in the anti-apartheid movement. He expects his son to join the police, but instead his son joins the resistance. Morgan Freeman didn't even give himself a cameo in this film. I was surprised, since I figured this is the kind of movie he would have liked to appear in.
I can't really see myself either in the Caribbean parts or African parts. I don't see it. I have trouble putting myself into that mindset, as it were. I don't think I look right, and I'm not a good mimic for accents. You know, I'm really afraid of offending someone.
What do you mean you don't think you look right?
There's a lot of red in my color as opposed to the blue undertones. I have a lot of red undertones. So when you do Africa, you need a lot of black under the blue undertone under there.
So you don't feel like it would be quite right for you?
No.
You were impersonating and not acting, is that it?
More than likely, yeah. And when I did The Power of One, you see, I was playing a Cape Colored. Now, that's a person of obvious mixed blood.
Mm-hmm.
So that I was kind of orangey against all that black skin. And that picture was okay.
Did you think anybody else would care, or do you think it's just you?
Well, it's not anybody else's decision.
Right. Right.
So I don't care if anybody else cares.
Right. Now, what about shooting? You shot the movie in Zimbabwe. Why did Zimbabwe seem like a good place to get the look for South Africa?
It was second choice.
Was South Africa first choice?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
My first choice was Alexandra in South Africa, which is probably the best model of township down there. But at the time, there was this growing animosity between the Inkatha and the ANC, and these confrontations were erupting all over the place. So the insurance company said, we can't possibly insure you under the circumstances because, you know, you can precipitate a riot yourself just by trying to film one of those scenes, and things could easily get out of hand there. So we thought, well, that's really true, so... Things are more controllable in Zimbabwe.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But the South African government gave us dispensation to come down there and set up and shoot. They were fine with it.
You held auditions in South Africa?
Yes, in Johannesburg I held auditions.
What was that like for you?
Well, you know, once you're in a room surrounded by people you know, and what's going on outside has little or nothing to do with it. And then the people I met, the young actors and all, you know, they look like any other actors except that they have very South African accents, you know. And it was the process, however, of auditioning, being an actor, is very difficult. As an actor, I know how difficult it is to go into a situation, even if you know the part well, if you know you can do it well, you resent having to stand across a desk from some twit who calls himself a director. He's looking at you with all kind of critical appraisal, and you've got to somehow show him something in 5 or 10 minutes that will prove to him that you can do this role, which you know you can walk through, you know, as a walkover for you. On the other hand, being the person who's got to make the choice, it's really deadly because some people audition well and don't act with beans, and on the other hand, some of the best actors just don't do auditions.
So how did you take that into account when you were holding auditions?
I try to diffuse that whole thing. I say to actors, in some manner of other or other, that I know what this situation is. You know, give it your best shot, and we'll do our best. You know, let's just. I've done this. I know it's not easy. I apologize.
My guest is Morgan Freeman, and he's just made his directorial debut in the new movie Bopa. I want to talk to you a little bit about your acting. Let's start with Glory, the Civil War movie about the first African-American unit in the military. Was this a chapter in American history that you already knew about? A lot of people learned about it through the movie.
Yeah. I had learned about the 54th Massachusetts from those little blurbs in Jet magazine, This Day in History.
Mm-hmm.
And they were talking about the charge on Fort Wagner and the fact that the sergeant... won the Congressional Medal of Honor for that during that charge.
I'm wondering if the story had special resonance for you because of your experiences in the Air Force. I know you were in the Air Force.
No, it had no resonances at all concerning my own time in the Air Force. It had all kinds of resonance, however, concerning my feeling about the chapters in American history that have been sort of... left out. I'm of the firm belief that as a country, not as a group within the country, but as a country, we all lose when we don't know our history.
I want to ask you about the film that I think first brought you a lot of attention, and I'm thinking of Street Smart, and it's a film, you know, unlike Bopa, it's not a film about an important freedom struggle. Unlike Glory, it's not a film about an important freedom struggle. It's a film about a pimp and a prostitute and a journalist who writes a phony story. You played the pimp in the movie. You know, a lot of African-American actors really feel sick that so many parts that have been available for the past couple of decades have been pimp roles. You transformed this pimp role into just an extraordinary performance. Did you realize that the part had the potential to be something really special when you read it?
I guess that's the way you do it. You know, you read a script and you're looking at the character that you're going to be playing and thinking how much difficulty or fun it's going to be. And when I read this, this guy was really fun for an actor because he was mercurial, you know? A character that you can play who has all these different shadings to go through, that's the actor's forte. That's his métier. That's what he wants to get into, and that's where you can chew, you know?
Can you give us a sense of what you felt you could do to make sure that this wasn't just a central casting type pimp role? Do you know what I mean? Like, when you thought about the role and what you wanted to do?
Well, after they told me I was going to be doing the role, I spoke to the costume designer, Joe Innocenzo, and I said, I don't want anything like crushed velvet or big collars or high heels. Or no, I want Saks Fifth Avenue.
Well, why?
Huh?
Why did you want Saks and not Superfly?
Because I didn't want to play this kind of stereotyped guy. I once met a pimp in Chicago, and he was... Now, he might not have been a pimp, I'll take that back, but he was definitely a well-connected procurer, okay? And I thought, now this is the guy. This is the character you want, you know? Guy who looks good, dresses well, presents himself well, is laid back, mixes in any crowd, and has a power. There's an aura around him that turns everybody on.
No, also in your role, you had this incredible viciousness that would just come out from out of nowhere, and it would be real scary when it did. I mean, there's this great scene where Kathy Baker, who plays a prostitute, where you think that she's betrayed you, so you take a knife and you tell her
scissors.
What? Scissors. I'm sorry, it's a scissors. That's right. And you tell her,
I'm going to take one of your eyes.
Yeah.
You just tell me which one you want to lose. Yeah.
And then you say the right, the left.
The left. Which? Yeah. And, you know, the power of that scene is the fact that Kathy believed me. So she was she was having to deal with making that choice. It was an extraordinary scene, but it was primarily because you were watching this woman's reaction. Yeah.
Morgan Freeman is my guest. He just directed his first film called Bopa. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Actor and director Morgan Freeman is my guest. I'm interested in your background. You were born in Memphis, grew up in Mississippi for the first few years of your life.
Yeah.
Raised until you were six by your grandmother.
My paternal grandmother, yeah.
Your paternal grandmother. Yeah. Where were your parents?
They were in Chicago. And when my paternal grandmother died, my biological father came down and got me and my sister. I have two brothers who were living with my maternal grandmother at the time. Mm. So, you know, we all wound up in Chicago there for a short while.
So when you went to live with your mother in Chicago, did you feel welcome? Did you feel that she wanted you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that was that was life as it should be. Yeah.
Had she not had the money to raise you before? Or?
Well, you know, my whole background all the way back as far as I can count is Mississippi. And going from Mississippi to Chicago, Detroit, New York, you name whatever urban center migrants go to, you get in on the bottom rung. Mm-hmm. So it's better not to be burdened with your young if you can leave them home and safe in some place, you know?
So what was it like for you when you got to Chicago?
Dreadful.
Uh-huh.
Just awful. It was the middle of the winter. I was not prepared in any kind of way to deal with. I mean, I came from Charleston, Mississippi. I mean, a little town where everybody, you know, the Africans have a saying, it takes a whole village to raise a child.
Yeah.
Well, I came from a situation where the whole village was raising me. And I wound up in a place where people don't even speak and they live in the same building. So it was a wrench. It was awful for a kid 6 years old and, you know, protected all his life.
Was it a very tough neighborhood?
Tough neighborhood. Couldn't go out, got on the street, couldn't get to school. I went to school and quit after about a week.
What, because you were afraid?
Oh, it was too awful. You had to run a gauntlet just to get from home. At the time, I lived a block from school. I couldn't make it.
So how'd you learn to defend yourself?
Well, after a period of time, you know, you see the do or die. You know, you can't just stay locked up in the house. You got to go out and face it, you know. And it's an amazing thing, too. You know, as a kid, you go out and you face the ones who grabbed you and threw you down and stuffed snow down your clothes or beat you up and sent you home. You come back out and you face them and they all laugh, you know.
Were you really tall as a kid?
No, I was very small and skinny. And
I can't imagine you short.
Well, don't think short. Think skinny.
Right. Okay. I can imagine you skinny. That's easy.
Yeah. I was very bookish, you know, and I read all the time. And was one of those strange kids.
What did you like to read?
Everything. Didn't really matter if it was a book, I read it. I read Black Beauty, my first book when I was 8 years old. You know, I'm a hardback book instead of a comic book.
Is reading bad for your image if you have to try to prove that you can defend yourself and that you could be...
No. Reading is never bad for your image on any level at all. What's bad for your image is not being able to stand up and fight in a situation. You know, that's really bad for your image.
Right.
You know, particularly in any urban setting. Yeah. You know, or I suppose any place. You got to be able to defend yourself on some level or other.
So did you join a gang or anything?
Oh, yeah. When some point we moved and up to 45th and South Parkway, and I had to... Well, you do that for self-protection, you know. If you're on this turf, you're in this gang, and then you can move around. But if you go to another set of, you know, the other section of town, then woe be unto you.
Did you ever get into the kind of trouble that could have ruined your life?
Well, I was certainly headed for it. Being in these little gangs and things, you have to sort of prove yourself to someone. It's generally someone who calls himself a leader, you know. So I remember once I stole a guy's bicycle from in front of a store. You know, the other guy said, "We'll wait here. You go get the bicycle, and you meet us around the corner." All right, fine. And I went and I got the bicycle, and of course the guy came out of the store and saw me on the street with his bicycle. Snatched it away from me, grabbed me by the collar, gave me one slap, and it just happened that a grown-up was coming by at the time and told him to leave me alone. I got free of that and was gone. But, you know, the lesson in this is I'm going to do wrong. I'm going to get caught.
Mm-hmm.
So I managed somehow or other to avoid a lot of the trouble that I should have gotten into being with this gang because I knew that if I did it, they were going to catch me, and I was going to pay.
Right. Now, you went into the Air Force.
Air Force, yeah.
Did you think about going to college?
I thought about it for a hot minute. I was in Mississippi at the time, and I knew that, I was sort of, you would call me a big fish in a little barrel at the time, because I had a good acting reputation out of high school, and I was offered partial scholarships in dramatics to go to Jackson State or to Tougaloo. But I was really tired of school. I really wanted to get out and do some living, you know, and have some adventures and be a fighter pilot, you know, do all the stuff I'd seen in the movies.
Did the Air Force give you what you were hoping for?
No. It gave me what I needed, but not what I thought I was hoping for.
So what did you need and what were you hoping for?
I thought I was hoping for a white scarf and...
I've seen that movie.
Right. And wings. An F-86 jet all my own, you know. But what it gave me was a sense of confidence and discipline and an entree to the world, you know, that sort of segue from dependency on community and school and family to being able to stand on my own and really come out and meet the world. And it also got me from Mississippi to Hollywood.
How did it get you to Hollywood?
Well, when I was discharged, I was in San Bernardino.
Oh.
It's a short hop, skip, and a jump, you know, a 45, 50-minute bus ride.
Now, how did you start auditioning or getting more training or whatever when you got to Hollywood?
Well, my first thought was, I've got to get somewhere. I got to go and get a job, you know. So I went to Paramount offices up on Sunset Boulevard, and I walked in and said, you know, my name is Morgan Freeman, and I'm an actor, and I'm looking for work. And the lady gave me this card to fill out and said, you know, what kind of office machines do you operate, and how many words do you type a minute, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and what's your job history? And I just graduated. I just got discharged from the service, and I don't do any of this kind of work. I'm an actor. Well, I didn't get very far. And So by, I don't know, this was in February. By May, I managed to get a job as a transcript clerk at a community college there, Los Angeles Community College, and enrolled in acting classes there. I never did really get to auditions and things like that in Hollywood. I left Los Angeles the year after that and went, you know, to New York.
And worked on the stage?
No. I just came to New York to see if I couldn't find work on the stage and all. You know, you come out from nowhere and you don't know how to, where to, who to. You just keep running after, you know, partially closed doors. You see somebody disappear through a door, you go running after them, and the door closes just as you get there. That sort of always happened. I went to the Negro Actors Guild on 42nd Street, and I climbed up these steps, and there was this guy sitting there, and there were all these sort of faded posters and things. And the whole thing could tell you that nothing's going on here. Nothing. You don't know about agents. You don't know about casting agents. You don't know how to. So you get a job. You know, I got a job as a telegrapher, and I stayed there until February, in the dead of winter, and then I decided to leave and went to San Francisco because I was going to leave the country ultimately and go to Paris. Heck with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I hadn't seen San Francisco, and so I went to San Francisco and managed, after a few months, to wind up in a little theater repertory company there. And that was my beginning. And from that, I got into dance. I started dancing and taking dance classes and stuff. And I stayed there until 1963 and left in September. And I came back to New York as a dancer.
What kind of dance? Broadway?
Yeah, right. Ballet, jazz, tap, all the stuff that Broadway dancers have to take.
Mm-hmm.
But that was my intro into the theater, because the most incredible and effective networking is among dancers.
Do you think that there are any advantages and disadvantages of having really made it as an actor, of really getting the kudos and the attention and the roles when you reach the age of 50, as opposed to when you were still in your 20s,
I think if I had really hit it in my 20s, I would have burned out. I would have drugged myself right into oblivion. You know, I don't think I would have had enough discipline, enough smarts to control it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you start making money and getting a lot of press, I think you need either someone around you who has a head much leveler than yours, or you need some age and experience, you know, something to make you know that this is all really here today and gone tomorrow. You know, it's transitory.
That's your attitude?
Yeah, that's my attitude. I bought a boat. If it all goes to hell, I set sail.
It's like the Noel Coward song, Sail Away.
Yeah.
So is that what you do when things are going bad? You get on your boat?
No. I do that. Things are never going bad.
Uh-huh.
They are never going bad.
Morgan Freeman, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, it was a pleasure.
Morgan Freeman directed the new film, Bopa. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Journalist Malcolm Brown was one of the younger foreign correspondents to first cover the war in Vietnam. He was probably the oldest correspondent to cover the Gulf War. Coming up, a talk with Malcolm Brown about his new memoir, Muddy Boots and Red Socks. And commentator Annie Lamott tells us about her real-life nightmare, defending single motherhood on national TV. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Congress has voted to close down 130 military bases and scale back another 45. Defense spending cutbacks will result in the loss of tens of thousands of jobs across the country. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
This is the third round of base closures in 5 years. Most of the direct job losses will occur in three states, California, Florida, and South Carolina. Among the major installations on the list are Alameda Naval Station in California, the Orlando Naval Training Center in Florida, and the Charleston Naval Shipyard in South Carolina. California Senator Dianne Feinstein tried some last-minute maneuvering to block the commission's recommendations. She argued that the panel failed to consider economic impacts. But Senator John Glenn, a member of the Armed Services Committee, countered, "It isn't possible to keep every base open. We don't need them," he said, "and we cannot continue to pay for them." The commission estimates $4 billion in savings in the first five-year period. Another round of base closures is slated for 1995. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
President Clinton's health care plan gained support from former U.S. Surgeon General Dr. C. Everett Koop this morning, who said that Mr. Clinton had already done more to solve the nation's health problems than all of those before him. A White House spokeswoman indicated that the president may deliver his speech this week to a joint session of Congress without making final decisions on how to pay for the health care plan because proposed increases in so-called sin taxes have not been decided upon. This morning, the president met with 100 doctors at the White House in his continuing efforts to gain support. The Clinton administration has announced plans for a donors' conference to raise funds for implementing the new Israeli PLO agreement on self-rule. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Foreign and finance ministers from European nations, Japan, the Gulf States, and Canada are being invited to the donors' conference. The meeting's expected to occur within a few weeks. The goal is to raise about $3 billion over the next decade. The Clinton administration hopes to provide $250 million during the next 2 years from existing foreign aid budgets. Christopher stressed that funds must start flowing quickly so Palestinians don't lose faith in the Israel PLO agreement.
All agree we must take immediate steps to address the high unemployment rate that robs families of hope and fuels extremism in the West Bank.
The Clinton administration will also appoint a task force of Jewish and Arab American leaders to encourage private investment in the region. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 37 points to close at 3,575.80 on volume of more than 228 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a margin of more than 5-4. This is NPR News. Syrian President Assad is quoted as saying that the Palestinian-Israeli peace agreement did nothing for the Arab cause and only Israel gained from the agreement. In an interview with an Egyptian newspaper, the Syrian leader said that secret talks leading up to the pact were not justified. The 21-member Arab League has endorsed the new agreement. In France, thousands of farmers held peaceful demonstrations today to indicate their opposition to the farm trade agreement between the United States and the European Community. The agreement that is seen as a stepping stone to a GATT accord is being considered by EC leaders. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
French farmers often resort to violence to make their views known, but today they opted for a gentle approach. Some groups of farmers demonstrated by parading huge tractors along country roads. Others gathered in towns and cities throughout the country and distributed free food to the locals. Usually they just dump it in anger on the highways. The farmers also passed out leaflets explaining that the farm trade deal being discussed in Brussels will kill French agriculture. The deal was negotiated by the EC, which has offices in Paris. During the day, about 300 farmers gathered outside the building and constructed a brick wall, which they covered with posters saying GATT will suffocate agriculture. The farmers threatened violent action if France gives in to the farm trade deal. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Meanwhile, France has called for support from its partners in the European community in the country's dispute with the U.S. over farm trade. Under an agreement reached last year in Washington, there will be large cuts in the size of subsidized farm exports. However, EC officials have indicated that there are no plans to work out a new trade agreement. President Clinton has refused to open up trade talks in the matter again. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Malcolm Brown was one of the younger reporters to cover the Vietnam War and about the oldest to cover the Gulf War. In 1961, he became the Associated Press's Saigon bureau chief. He covered the Vietnam War for close to a decade. He shared a Pulitzer Prize with David Halberstam in 1964. He was 60 when he went to the Gulf for the New York Times. He's been a foreign correspondent for most of his career, but now he's a science reporter for the Times. He's written a new memoir called Muddy Boots and Red Socks. The book includes a horrifying photograph Brown took in 1963 that became a familiar image around the world. It was a picture of a Buddhist monk sitting in the lotus position while completely engulfed in flames. This was the first Vietnamese monk to set himself on fire in protest against the authoritarian regime. Brown told me about the day he took that picture.
Well, in brief, it was one of the worst days of my life, that's for sure. I had known sometime in advance that there would be a demonstration, but of course I had no idea that there'd be an immolation. In those days, this was the summer of 1963, there was an upheaval going on in Vietnam, led by the Buddhist monks against the Catholic presidency of Ngo Dinh Diem, but also, just in general, against the government. There was great discontent, popular discontent with the government. What actually happened, the procession led to a downtown street corner in Saigon, one of the busiest corners in that bustling city, and then it stopped suddenly, and among the marchers was an automobile. It was an old Austin, as a matter of fact, and the old monk got out of the Austin, accompanied by two much younger monks carrying a jerry can full of gasoline. And Thich Quang Duc seated himself on a little pallet or pillow in the center of the intersection. The other two monks poured gasoline over him. He lighted himself. And he was not in a trance or anything. His face was agonized. He was clearly going through the horrors of burning to death without any palliative for his pain. And it took him, I suppose, about 10 minutes to die. And I've been asked how I could stand to watch this thing. Well, I had work to do. I think news correspondents in general find a release in work. If you have to concentrate on the exposure setting of a camera or of taking notes or anything of that sort, you tend to overlook the horrors that you may be witnessing. And that was what kind of saved me that day, I suppose.
You did write, though, that you were trying hard not to perceive what you were witnessing.
Yes, that's absolutely right, because If I really had perceived it and thought about it, I suppose I just couldn't have stood it.
Now, did you write the story as well as take the pictures?
Oh, yes, of course. Pictures really do have a great deal more impact than words, and sometimes sometimes misleadingly so. Pictures are not necessarily as realistic as words. It's been argued by some critics. Well, I should say that that it had an immediate impact on the White House. It happened that Henry Cabot Lodge was just getting ready to come out to Saigon as U.S. ambassador at the time that happened. And as he was getting his final briefing by President Kennedy, he noticed that my photograph on Kennedy's desk, and Kennedy made some comment about how we're going to really have to do something about that government in Saigon. But the picture did obviously have a great impact. It was used as a propaganda photograph by Peking for some time. Moscow used it also with captions like, a Buddhist monk burns in protest against U.S. imperialism, all that kind of thing. It became sort of a symbol. Many many things to many different people. I think to this day, as a matter of fact, it's exhibited in Saigon. I know it is, attached to the car that brought Thich Quang Duc to his suicide. And so it's sort of venerated as part of the iconography of the death of that monk.
I want to ask you about another story that you covered in Vietnam. And this is a story you were very personally involved in. You were shot down in a helicopter in Vietnam. You were knocked unconscious. And then when you got conscious again, you had to write up the story, of course, leaving out the more personal aspects of it. But you write in the book, and I found this very interesting, that it was really difficult for you to kind of convey the impact of the story, and that a lot of writers, you think, in that kind of situation find themselves resorting to clichés.
That's absolutely right. Somehow, whatever skills one have seemed to desert one after a day like that, after one is sort of literally cheated death. Actually, I was shot down three times. The one you're talking about was early in the war in an H-21, a banana-shaped helicopter. If you've been sort of dragged away from your task of writing and confronted death, your whole sort of mental outlook changes just long enough to foul up your writing quite badly for at least 24 hours.
What kind of difference in reporting and writing styles did you find between the older and the younger journalists in Vietnam?
Most of the older ones, by the way, who were not resident in Vietnam in those years, they, for the most part, they came from their bases either in Hong Kong or Tokyo, or in some cases from the United States. But they, for the most part, had been schooled in World War II and Korea, which were entirely different wars from Vietnam, of course. They were wars in which there were large battles in which you might have to confront a charge by North Korean or Chinese tanks coming down through one of the passes and watch your comrades killed on the spot and so on. The Vietnam War was different in that territory made very little difference. It truly was a war for the hearts and minds, to use that old cliche that was so popular in Washington for a while. You could take a ridgeline or a village or some kind of terrain feature, capture it absolutely, conquer it, raise your flag, and 24 hours later it wouldn't matter at all because you'd have pulled out. It was not something worth keeping, nor would the other side hold on to it if you abandoned it to them. It was not a war of territory, and it had to be understood in the context of politico-military combat, which is something that we, I think, never really came quite to grips with.
In your book, you write that the universal hallmark of war, the smell of war, is feces mixed with burned and decaying flesh. What is the place of that smell in written coverage? In other words, how much of that should you be letting in, do you think, when you're a journalist covering war?
I think all of it should be ventilated, but of course, physically, you can't smell on television or in the newspaper, fortunately. Also, people who dish up news for breakfast are a little bit leery about including some of the more gruesome details of these things. The pictures that I took of the Buddhist monk who burned himself, for example, fully half of the newspapers in the United States simply refused to publish that on grounds that it was too disgusting for breakfast fare, including the New York Times, by the way. So I'd say that it's a problem, and individual editors and news directors solve it according to their tastes, I guess.
Journalist Malcolm Brown is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Malcolm Brown, author of the new memoir, Muddy Boots and Red Socks. Your mother was a Quaker and a pacifist, and I don't think you shared her religion, and you ended up in the army during the Korean War, and then spent many years covering wars. Is there any element of pacifism in you that you feel you inherited from your mother?
I guess my appreciation of her views came rather late in life. I came more and more to feel that that all wars are evil, even the good ones. We were sort of, I grew up in the 30s, and we were, many of us believed that there was only one side. In Spain, for example, the Spanish Civil War was clearly a war between the good guys and the fascists. And we sort of had the feeling that if only we had gone and fought the fascists, we might not have had to fight World War II. Well, a kind of revelation came to me when I was covering the death of Franco in the mid-70s, that somehow the war in Spain had been utterly wasted of lives. There were about 2 million people altogether killed there. The bad guys won, hands down, and yet when it was all over, Franco died peacefully in his sleep. There was a transition almost overnight from a fascist dictatorship to a constitutional monarchy, a democracy. And you just have to wonder, even that great war, immortalized by Hemingway and Orwell and all of these great writers of the 30s, was it really worth it? And I think that it's possible to look at any war and say, gee, why did those people have to die? So I guess I sort of end my career in the same way that my mother began hers, as with a feeling that war is intrinsically evil and it should be avoided at all cost.
I want to take you back to Vietnam for a minute. You were there during the evacuation of Saigon. Did you have responsibility for other people and their evacuation?
Well, our bureau had...
This was the bureau for...
For the New York Times. We had about 20 Vietnamese staffers and their families. My wife is Vietnamese, and although she's been a U.S. citizen for many years, her family was sort of caught in the maelstrom and was divided up. Some of them came to the United States, and some decided that they should probably remain in Vietnam. This was an agony that virtually every family in South Vietnam went through. They had to decide whether to go to the new world, where there was a completely alien environment, cold weather, reports of racism here and there, or to stay at home and face the possibility of going to a re-education camp or these other horrors that were perpetrated by the Hanoi regime. It was an agonizing decision for everyone. And that was probably the roughest time in my career, trying to sort things out a little bit for our own staff and for so many other Vietnamese with whom I'd been in contact in one way or another, who were eager to get out of the country. And so, it was a terrible time.
What did you have to do to help other people out from the Times?
I'd have to say at this point that I think the CIA really came through in a very humane and wonderful way in the final weeks of the war. And if he should hear it, I think the station chief, Tom Polgar, should know that I feel that way about him and his operation. They decided, after a lot of to-ing and fro-ing and some pressure from the media and so forth, that there was an obligation on the part of the United States to get out those Vietnamese who were liable to be subject to imprisonment or torture or death by virtue of their associations with Americans, and they came crashing through. And so some of us, my colleague Dave Greenway of the Washington Post and I, we had a little arrangement. We'd ferry as many people out on a given day to the airport. The airport was under guard, and Vietnamese couldn't get into it without having some escorts. And so Dave and I would escort them in, sneak them past the guards, sneak them into the Air America hangar so they could get out, and that sort of thing. It was I think most of the correspondents there were doing the same thing. We were trying to get out our friends, basically.
How many people do you think you helped out?
It's hard to say. The so-called black airlift, black because it was supposedly secret, got out thousands of people, not all of them connected with the media, of course. There were people in the Vietnamese armed forces and the Vietnamese intelligence, Vietnamese police, and so forth. Many people who had some sort of claim to American loyalties when the roof caved in. There were many thousands of them, and it was every day the airport was just jam packed with people who were on their way into the black airlift.
Was there a part of you that considered staying behind after the fall of Saigon?
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to stay behind, but the only American left with me at that point, Fox Butterfield, and I had our orders 2 days before the end from the publisher, Arthur Ochs Sulzberger, who insisted that we come out. No ifs, ands, or buts. There had been Sidney Shanberg of the New York Times, who was in covering Phnom Penh, opted to remain in Cambodia after April 17th, after the Khmer Rouge took over there. And I know that this was a source of great concern and worry and inconvenience and high insurance rates and all kinds of problems for the New York Times. And the Times simply didn't want that repeated in Vietnam.
I never think of insurance rates as being something that enters into these decisions, but I guess it does.
Oh, very much so. Insurance rates were prevented me, really, from going to Phnom Penh to bring out our staffers in Cambodia. At the time, we on the outside felt that they probably wanted to get out. And the problem was that the airport, the Po Chin Thang Airport at Phnom Penh, was by that time already under fire, under mortar fire and howitzer fire. And our airplanes, the Times airplane, was insured, of course, for war risk problems. But you needed something called extraordinary war risk to actually land at an airport that was under fire. And that we couldn't get, or rather it was just too expensive and too complicated to get in time. And so I wasn't able to do it.
Have you ever had to use your war insurance policy?
No, I've been I've been, you know, cut up a little bit by flying metal now and then, but never anything very serious. The war risk really covers the airplane rather than the person, and in most cases the airplanes are two engine things that are really very expensive. They can run up to about $1 million, so that's what you're paying for when you buy insurance, that and the life of the pilot. The correspondent is, of course, expendable.
Nice way to look at it. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Malcolm Brown is science correspondent for the New York Times. His new memoir is called Muddy Boots and Red Socks. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
We'll be hearing about health care reform, Terry. You know, on Wednesday night, President Clinton makes his address to Congress to officially unveil his health care reform plans. Today, a teach-in, they called it a university on the Hill about health care reform. We'll be hearing about that. Also, Patricia Naiman tells us about which ideas are common to all the major health care reform proposals, what is likely really to happen because everyone agrees it should. We'll also be hearing today about the elections in Poland, a victory for the former Communist Party and one of its allies there. And we'll also be hearing from Zbigniew Brzezinski about why that should have happened.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A few months ago, a Census Bureau report came out with the news that a lot more single women were having babies. Soon after, writer Annie Lamott, herself a single mother of a 4-year-old, got a call to be on a national TV talk show in New York. They asked her to fly out from California to be on the show for 12 minutes. She said yes.
2 days after I got the call, I told my son Sam that he would be staying with my mother overnight, and he said in effect that it would be hard for him, but okay. I say in effect because when he feels strongly about something, he tends to sound a little like Squeaky Fromm after way too much caffeine, impassioned but incoherent. Then I flew to New York, checked into my hotel, ate my body weight in various room service atrocities, and waited to be picked up for the show. I rehearsed my speech on why I think that having no dad around is infinitely better than a bad dad, thought of some salty but spiritual things to say about single motherhood, practiced smiling prettily, and preened. The publicist picked me up about 10:30 that night, and we headed over to the studio. Then the publicist said, "Be sure to jump in as often as possible." I said, "Say what?" She said, "The men are supposedly real heavies, and you should jump in whenever possible." I thought about this for a minute and said, "What men?" And she said, "Oh, the men on the panel." I peered intently into her face. "Oh, dear," she said, "you didn't get our message. It's become a panel." Another woman, a brilliant, kind feminist writer, and two men were waiting in the green room. Everyone was very pleasant before the show began, but then the camera started rolling and the talk show host turned to the camera and said tersely, "They used to call them illegitimate. They used to call them bastards." And I thought, uh-oh. It turned out that the four of us were supposed to have a debate on whether or not the increase in urban violence could be traced directly to the increase in single motherhood. "The consensus is in," the men thundered, Zeus-like. In all fairness, I do not think that they would agree that they had thundered, and especially that it had been in any way Zeus-like. Nor do I think the two men would use the phrase Jurassic to describe themselves. I'm sure they'd disagree that they'd imply that the children of most single mothers were turning out like the kids in Lord of the Flies. But I sat there feeling stunned and totally ashamed. My mind went blank, like after you shake one of those old Etch-a-Sketch machines, and I kept looking around for my nice 12-minute spot, the one where I got to talk about my beautiful son, the one where I got to laugh prettily. This one, it turned out, was the one where I got to feel like I was having an MSG attack in front of 500,000 people. At some point, it was over, and I felt like I should have just stayed home, which is an unhappily familiar feeling. But finally, back at my hotel, I remembered something a friend of mine once told me, the 5 rules of the world by which we were raised. The first rule is that you must not have anything different about you. The second rule is that if you do, you must get over it as quickly as possible. The third is that if you can't get over it, you should pretend that you have. The fourth is that if you can't even fake it, then don't show up because it's hard on the rest of us. And the fifth rule is that if you insist on showing up, you should at least have the good graces to be ashamed. And all of a sudden, I felt like $1 million again. There is something different about my family. I don't have a husband. The men on the show think I should, but what they think is none of my business. I'd sort of forgotten that. I called Sam to say goodnight. God, he is so beautiful, so sweet. He told me a long, squeaky Fromoid story about his latest adventures, and I had to close my eyes as his story and relief washed over me like a brook.
Annie Lamott is the author of Operating Instructions, a journal of my son's first year. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Chris Fraley, Audrey Voblitis, and Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, ethnobotanist Mark Plotkin tells us about what he learned from shamans in the rainforest. Also, Native American writer Sherman Alexei on his new collection of short stories, The Lone Ranger and Tonto, Fistfight in Heaven. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.